The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled Penguins with Attitude by Cheryl Katz. Will Rockhopper's legendary grit and daredevil athleticism be enough to protect them in a rapidly warming world? On a rocky ledge over the coast of an island in the far South Atlantic Ocean, young penguin peers nervously at the chasm ahead. Her bushy yellow eyebrows waggle as she tilts her head one way, then another, scouting the route home to her nest high above. The next step will be a doozy. To reach the ledge on the other side, she'll have to make a gravity-defying leap more than twice her diminutive height. Her wet feathers shimmer in the setting sun as she musters her courage. "You can do it," Petra Quillfelt coaxes the little penguin. "You're a rock hopper." The coach's confidence is well-founded. Quillfelt, a seabird ecologist from Justus Liebig University, Gießen in Germany, has been visiting this southern rockhopper colony in the Falkland Islands for nearly 20 years, studying how the penguins, with their piston-like bodies, are being affected by climate and ocean conditions. As if buoyed by the pep talk, the hesitant bird cocks her flightless wings. Her powerful pink feet push off the rock with tremendous force. She catapults across the gap and sticks the landing with the clasp of strong, gripping claws. After a beat to shake her feathers and toss us a backward glance, she hops off to join her colony mates bounding up the steep hill. Penguins, those shambling stars of nature films, are some of the world's most familiar and beloved birds. We're inspired by their quiet stoicism and amused by their clumsy, waddling gait. But southern rockhoppers, little balls of muscle with outsized personalities, are the badasses of the penguin world. Roughly the size of a pet rabbit, rockhoppers are the smallest penguins to ply the cold, rough waters north of Antarctica. With their bright ruby eyes, whimsical gold crests, and spiky black crowns, they sport an adorable pixie punk look. Rockhoppers surf the gnarliest breaks, fight with birds many times their size, and pick constant noisy squabbles with their neighbors. Their full-throttle lifestyle makes them favorites among people who live and work in the Falklands, a Connecticut-sized cluster of around 780 islands, roughly 400 miles east of the southern coast of South America. "They've got attitude. They're always doing something," says Adrian Lowe, a farmer who has three rockhopper colonies on his sheep pasture near Stanley, the Falklands capital. "They're tough." At Quillfelt's study colony on New Island, an eight-mile-long crescent near the archipelago's western edge, lines of pint-sized commuters in black and white suits snake up a winding gully. It's mid-December, the end of a long austral summer day, and these rockhoppers have been fishing since dawn, 14 hours ago. "And then they have to go home and feed the chicks," Quillfelt notes wryly. To get back to their nests, microchip penguins must pass through a radio frequency gateway at the colony's entrance, which logs their comings and goings. "The birds bouncing past us now are all nearly mothers," Quillfelt tells me. One way the rockhoppers have adapted to their food-limited, energy-demanding environment is that males stay in the colony guarding the chicks and don't eat for roughly a month, while chicks are with them full-time. Only females forage while the chicks are in the nest. Their flexible stomach physiology makes them essentially refrigerators for the day's catch of krill and small fish. They digest some of the prey they swallow, but as they head back to land, their digestion shuts down and their stomach cools, keeping the food fresh for hungry chicks. I watch these intrepid mamas ride the churning surf below, porpoising over surging waves to shore, then blasting belly first onto jagged seaweed-slicked rocks. Some land, pop up on their feet, and make a mad dash out of the way of the next wave. Most, however, wipe out and get swept back to sea. They'll have to try and try again. Rockhopper's penchant for colonies high over perilous landings separates them from other penguin species that call the Falklands home. Meligelanx, kings, macaronis, and gentoos. Those other penguins usually build their colonies on soft, level ground with easy access to water, says Juan Macello, a behavioral ecologist who is also Quillfelt's husband. But not grasshoppers. They go for the worst, he says. Indeed, according to Sarah Crofts, a seabird biologist who has worked with Falklands bird life for nearly two decades, these daredevils don't even seem to consider the prospect of failure. They only say, we'll give it a go, we'll try and scale this huge cliff to get to the colony, or we'll fight an albatross to defend our nest. It's just the way they're built, determined. Like most penguins today, however, these tough little birds are facing some big problems. Rockhoppers, members of the crested penguin, Eudapites genus, have recently been divided into three species, southern, also sometimes called western, northern, also known as Moseley's, and eastern. More than half of the world's rockhoppers are southern rockhoppers, which breed primarily in the subpolar Falklands and along the southern coast of South America. Colonies of the considerably less populous northern rockhoppers are found mainly on temperate South Atlantic islands, much farther north, while eastern rockhoppers have their range around New Zealand and the southern Indian Ocean. Populations of all three species have plummeted in recent years. Southern rockhoppers, believed to have once numbered in the several millions worldwide, fell to an estimated 850,000 breeding pairs in a 2010 census and were classified as vulnerable on the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species in 2020. The species decline is especially concerning in the Falklands, where more than a third of all southern rockhoppers are born. Once teeming colonies have become noticeably sparse. Scientists estimate that some 1.5 million rockhopper couples raised chicks along the archipelago in the 1930s. By 1996, that number had dropped to fewer than 300,000. Last century's precipitous plunge of rockhoppers in the Falklands appears to have tapered, for now. With a lifespan of 10 to 15 years, the species can withstand the occasional disaster and rebuild the population over time. But as colonies here in the Falklands struggle to recover, a string of catastrophes during recent breeding seasons have repeatedly knocked them back down. In the early 2000s, for instance, tens of thousands of rockhoppers and other penguins died from consuming prey poisoned by toxic algal bloom. Colonies have also been clobbered by food shortages that cause mass starvation of adults. What's more, chick survival in the Falklands has slumped for the past three decades. Changing weather is unleashing unseasonably intense storms, killing downy chicks that haven't yet grown their warm, waterproof feathers. Predation is also taking a toll. Rockhoppers generally mate for life and raise one or occasionally two chicks per season. Chicks, slow to mature, don't breed until they're around 4 years old. Penguins spend most of their lives at sea and only come onto land to breed. These days, however, too few chicks live to fledge at the end of most seasons to help boost the numbers when they return as adults. Outside Quillfelt's study colony, it's getting dark, and rush hour has slowed to a trickle. As we head back to the lab, from the colony behind us, the enthusiastic brays of reuniting couples, the insistent peeps of hungry chicks, and the screeching spats between neighbors follow us, growing louder as it gets later. The next evening, I struggle to keep up with Quillfelt and Macello as they march through dense tuskic grass on their way back to the New Island study colony. The stiff native grass is taller than I am, and I feel a moment of panic when it totally enfolds me. Then I spot the long pole strapped to Macello's backpack. He'll use it to snare six rockhoppers that have pencil case-sized black tape boxes taped to their backs. The boxes, which he and Quillfelt attached 3 days earlier, contain GPS data loggers that record locations. Some also track diving and other movements. Now the researchers will peel off the equipment and upload the birds' foraging tracks. The information will give the scientists a critical read on ocean conditions revealed by the birds' responses. The Falklands riveted worldwide attention in 1982, when Argentina and the United Kingdom fought a brief but brutal war for control over this remote, isolated smattering of islands. Today, the archipelago and its 3,500 or so human residents are administered by the UK as a self-governing British overseas territory. New Ireland, however, was named by American whalers who landed there in the late 1700s. The island went on to host more than a century of commercial slaughter of seals, whales, and other wildlife, including an 1800s operation that rendered rock hoppers for oil, and an early 1900s whaling station. In 1813, New Ireland was the scene of an infamous sabotage when a group of castaways, rescued by American sea captain Charles H. Barnard, stole his ship and left the Good Samaritan and his crew marooned. More recently, like much of the Falklands, New Ireland was used to farm sheep. For decades, thousands of livestock roamed the island, leaving a trampled landscape in their wake. Menson Bound, a fifth-generation British Falkland Islander, spent his boyhood summers on New Ireland in the late 1950s and 1960s, working for his uncle John Davis, known as Cracker Jack, who was then the island's owner. Over tea and Christmas cake in his Stanley summer home, Bound tells me about helping cut down tussock and building roads and fences as part of his uncle's quest to transform the land. His uncle had a ruthless view of nature, Bound recalls. Anything that moved was killed, pretty much, except for the sheep. Such practices capped centuries of habitat damage for the island's numerous species of seabirds. Grass clearing, underway since the whalers burned huge swaths, exposed nests to the elements and predators. Lush peat beds eroded down to bare rock. Cats, rabbits, and other imported animals and plants crowded out natives. Today, in a karmic U-turn, New Ireland is a national nature reserve. The turnabout began in the 1970s, when the British conservationist Ian Strange bought the island from Davis's family, removed the sheep, and started restoring the native environment. The non-governmental organization Falklands Conservation now owns the island and continues its restoration, with hopes of removing the island's invasive rabbits if it can secure the funds. The island today is largely uninhabited, save for visiting scientists, day-tripping cruise passengers, and a pair of wardens who supervise a small seasonal tourist operation. An old stone farmhouse stands along the path to the rockhopper colony, about a half a mile away. The path ends in this rebounding grassland at the island's crest, where we follow our ears to the raucous colony on the other side. We emerge at the edge of a field in the sloping headland, stamped by countless pink feet over hundreds of years. The colony pulses with black and white motion, penguins bouncing up and down rock tiers, swirling around nests, greeting, preening, cuddling, fighting. Around 5,300 rockhopper couples are breeding at this particular colony this year, Quillfelt estimates. That number has ranged from some 4,000 to 12,000 in recent years. Fluffy gray chicks, around 3 weeks old, cling to their father's bellies. Most nests hold a single chick, a few have twins, and all of the babies have their bills wide open for their returning mothers to regurgitate dinner. Quillfelt and I crouch in the tall grass at the colony's edge as Macello wades into the fray. Treading gingerly over the poop-streaked ground, he approaches one of the females, snags her feet, scoops her up, and carries her back to us. "Poor birdie," Quillfelt says softly to the squirming penguin. The scientists gently remove the bird's kit, weigh her, and mark her white belly with the stripe so that she won't be recruited again. The activity draws the attention of curious colony mates, which come over to watch. "You can be my next volunteer," Macello tells one especially nosy neighbor that tries to peer over his arm as he works. The crowd grows as the released penguin hops back to her nest and Macello wades into the colony again. Later in the scientist's field station, a two-story wooden building in New Ireland's tiny settlement, decorated with artwork by previous researchers, we crowd around a computer screen waiting for the foraging female's data to assemble on the map. Quillfelt looks concerned as the tracks appear. Rather than foraging in the open ocean, which is Goodyear's swarms with energy-rich crustaceans, the birds are foraging mainly between islands, where they're likely catching tiny critters called lobster krill that are harder to digest. "That means that the colony's food scenario this year is probably suboptimal," Quillfelt says. The scientists will deploy the penguin loggers again during the month they spend on New Ireland. But the data so far jives with Quillfelt's observations about the colony's food supply. "Two things when we arrived caught my attention," she tells me. One is that there are very few nests with two chicks. In other years, we have quite a few. This observation relates to southern rock hoppers' unusual reproductive strategy, another adaptation to their unforgiving environment. Females lay two eggs at separate times, first a small A egg, followed by a larger B egg several days later. In contrast to most other birds, rockhopper's second egg hatches up to 3 days earlier than the first. That head start gives bee chicks a crucial and generally lethal advantage over smaller siblings when the food supply is limited, as this year's appears to be. It's a harsh practicality, allowing parents to focus on their most viable chick while providing a backup just in case. And when the food is abundant, both chicks can survive, helping the population rebound. Quillfelt also notes that mothers are losing more weight than usual while foraging this year, which means they're working harder to provide for their chicks. They are okay, she says, but it's not a luxury year. Seabirds in the Falkland Islands rely on cold, nutrient-rich water flowing north from Antarctica to deliver food to colonies along the coast. Some years, however, the current weakens and warm, nutrient-poor subtropical water pushes south, resulting in Spartan provisions. Though rockhoppers, like most seabirds, have always grappled with vacillating ocean conditions, the Falkland Islands lie just north of the Southern Ocean, one of the planet's fastest warming ocean basins. Around half or more of the atmosphere's excess heat our oceans have soaked up since 2005 is stored in these Antarctic and sub-Antarctic waters, dialing up wind speeds, intensifying weather, and disturbing ocean circulation across the region. Despite their bravado, rockhoppers are highly sensitive to change. Research by Quillfelt, Macello, and their colleagues shows that even a slight increase in sea temperature can disrupt the bird's food supply and lower chick and adult survival. And moving south to cooler waters isn't an option. Like many penguins, southern rockhoppers nest only on islands, and the next islands south of the Falklands are across a long, rough stretch of the Southern Ocean. The constant westerly winds there would push the little penguins east to the icy coasts of Antarctica, Quillfelt says. There's no land there where they can build new colonies. I think of the vast, empty southern expanse as I head south in a small twin-engine airplane. I'm in a Falklands government-operated air taxi, the main way to travel between most of the few dozen small settlements scattered across the archipelago. We're en route to Sea Lion Island, the largest of a five-island group and the Falklands' southernmost inhabited outpost. Here, clinging to wind-beaten headlands over treacherous seas, are what biologist Croft calls the most extreme southern rockhopper nesting sites of all. The plane lands on a grass strip near the nature lodge that Croft runs with her partner, Mickey Reeves. A rutted truck meanders to Rockhopper Point. In her former job monitoring seabirds for Falklands Conservation, Crofts visited rockhopper colonies throughout the Falklands and beyond. I can see what she means about the extreme nature of this one. Rockhoppers cluster on the exposed landscape, a monochrome of bare rocks and guano. A white snowy sheathbill scavenges a chick's corpse. Thudding waves spray seawater from the ocean a few hundred feet away, where tiny black and white figures swirl around battering rocks. Those that have already conquered the death-defying landing are leaping and crawling their way back up the vertical path to the colony. I don't know what the first rockhopper was thinking when he said, "Yeah, I can get up there," Crofts muses. They're like these adrenaline junkies, really hardcore. But sea lions rockhoppers have also suffered recent breeding disasters. Storms mowed down chicks in the 2010 to 2011 season, and again in 2013 to 2014, 20 to 21, and 2021 to 2022. The mass starvation that swept the archipelago in 2016 wiped out many of the island's adults. The 2020 storms also drove away the imperial cormorants that normally nest alongside rockhoppers and help shield each other's youngsters from predators. The cormorant population never returned. Southern giant petrels devastated rockhopper chick crops after that. So Crofts has been outfitting the colony with some creative art and architecture. The results are an amusing sight. Packs of young rockhoppers mill around stone slab structures that look like miniature Flintstones houses. They're chaperoned by a squad of stone cormorant sculptures watching silently. Crofts began building the bunkers in 2022 after the back-to-back calamities sparked the idea to give chicks a place to hide from future tempests and marauders. The decoy cormorants, cement casts made from a taxidermist model, were placed in hopes of luring real ones back to the colony. The chicks are now around 4 weeks old and are creching, a sort of penguin version of middle school. Over the next several weeks, they'll spend more and more time away from their parents, hanging out in groups, practicing moves, and putting on attitude. They'll shed their baby fluff and grow grayish, water-resistant juvenile feathers, getting ready to continue their journey to adulthood in the sea. As with humans, the transition from nestling to fledgling is one of the most vulnerable stages of a chick's life. Croft's efforts seem to be helping. The number of chicks that have survived to fledge on Sea Lion Island has steadily risen, from 86 in 2022, before the shelters were installed, to 260 this year. The cormorants had a slower start. Despite the decoys being beautifully painted by Sarah in realistic black and whites, Reeves says, the living cormorants continued to steer clear. Then this winter, there must have been quite a big storm, so they all got washed around and messed up a bit, he goes on with a grin. The weather-beaten decoys turned grayish, spattered with guano, and the cormorants started breeding there again. Crofts aims to get as many of the colony's rockhopper chicks fledged as possible, so they'll return as adults to help rebuild the area's population from the current 400-some breeding pairs to a more sustainable level of around 500. She and Reeves are trying to reestablish the native tussock grass, which, as in much of the Falklands, was stripped during the island's former days as a farm. The resort hosts a volunteer planting weekend every year. Photos from the 1930s show these cliffs covered with rockhoppers, Crofts tells me. It's a shift to living in our world that they're obviously struggling with. It may be impossible to stop the changes sweeping the ocean habitat, she adds, but to help them on land at the breeding sites is something we can actually do. In the short sub-Antarctic summer, chicks must grow up fast. I can see them change day by day. The shy nestlings clinging to their fathers 2 weeks ago have nearly doubled in size. Now bold, 5-week-olds bounce around the colony like fuzzy basketballs. Soon, at the ripe age of around 10 weeks, they'll be off to sea. The chicks appear robust, but food shortage effects are apparent to the researchers. We've seen them fatter, Quillfelt tells me. Some years they look like they're going to burst. Still, she thinks they're doing okay. The 2024 to 2025 breeding season on New Island turned out to be average, she'll tell me later, after the chicks have fledged. Most of the single chicks survived. The adults, too, made it through the season without incident. Crofts reports a similar outcome on Sea Lion Island. In the short term, rockhoppers in the Falkland Islands appear to be holding their own. As long as there are no other harmful events in between, the breeding success itself would be okay, Quillfelt says of the New Island colony. The critical colonies here remain too small and produce too few new breeders to buffer the population from future catastrophes. The scenario is similar throughout the southern rockhoppers' range, and catastrophes are almost certain to come. Rockhoppers already push their bodies to the limit. I think of the young rockhopper leaping over a daunting chasm, the moms up at sunrise hurling themselves into washing machine seas, the half-grown chicks trying out daredevil acrobatics. I asked the scientists, can rockhopper's moxie be an asset to their survival? Personality can be very important, Quillfelt tells me. Curiosity and boldness can spur seabirds to find ways to adapt, such as trying different foods and scouting out new breeding sites. And character can shape genetics through natural selection, Macello adds, recalling a rockhopper that bit and scratched him during sensor deployment the other day. If I were a predator that had a first encounter with that one, I would leave that one in peace and go for another one, he says. On my last day on New Island, after dinner, we headed back to the colony in search of guano. We tail rockhoppers, waiting for them to produce samples for diet analysis. When they deliver, Quillfelt quickly scrapes up the gooey output and drops it into a vial Macello has ready. The little penguins cock their heads and look at us directly in the eye, as if wondering what's up with these giant, crazy creatures. Down at the landing, a gentoo and a Magellanic penguin appear to have washed up in the wrong place. They stare at the rockhopper's airborne maneuvers, crane their necks to scrutinize the powerful pink feet. The spectators try to leap, but they fail to get off the ground. With a sad backward glance at the bouncing rock hoppers, the other penguins give up and waddle back down to the sea. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section of Smithsonian. This one's in Origins, and it's titled Creative License by Donna Albrecht, The Colorful True History Behind Our Laminated Identities. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, American cities were confronting a new invasive species, the car. Up and down the streets of San Francisco, the automobiles are sizzling and steaming, lamented the San Francisco Call in December 1901, as the new terror of locomotion has been added to the traffic. That fear was real. In the heady first years of widespread automobile use, anyone at any age was free to drive a motor car wherever they wanted, and at whatever speed their early machines could achieve. Stop signs, lane markings, even driving lessons were non-existent. Eventually, local governments led the efforts to rein in these horseless carriages. Chicago introduced an 18-question exam for drivers in 1899, while other jurisdictions focused instead on licensing the vehicles, as New York, for one, did in 1903. Pennsylvania instituted the first age requirements for drivers in 1909. The first driver's license that we would recognize came in 1910 when New York Assemblyman Albert S. Callan sponsored a new law requiring chauffeurs to pass an examination to secure a license, a paper document with their photo on the back side. California became the first state to feature the photo on the front in 1958. Soon stocked with more personal data, height, eye color, whether the driver wore glasses, the licenses became useful as proof of identity. For a long time, driver's licenses were relatively easy to fake, making them an easy tool for underage drinkers and others to seeking to cloak their identity. Of the first high-tech additions, appearing on licenses in the 1990s, was a magnetic stripe, developed in the 1960s by IBM, that allowed law enforcement to verify a person's identity. Later, after 9/11 terrorists breached airport security using counterfeit IDs, states added more stringent security features. Today's licenses now boast holograms that appear when the license is tilted, microprinting, text hidden inside another visual component, and sometimes minute perforations made by lasers to form a state-specific image. In California, for example, it's a brown bear. Today, some states are phasing out these magnetic stripes. In October of last year, California introduced new license designs bursting with redwoods and golden poppies, replacing the stripes with a barcode containing a unique security signature. Now, as digital wallets continue to displace leather ones, states from Hawaii to Louisiana are beginning to accept virtual licenses via smartphone or even a smartwatch. Some states, such as Michigan, even allow you to take the written portion of your driving test online. Regardless, once the rubber hits the road, you'll need ID. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.